You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And at one point he asked me, "Well, listen, Hans, you know so much about chemical weapons. Would you like to write an article for the internal magazine of my ministry?"
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Hans de Vrij is a Dutch journalist who has worked in Berlin, Brussels, Geneva, and Prague. Whilst working at the United Nations in Geneva, Hans was the subject of an attempted recruitment by the KGB to develop an agent of influence to disseminate Soviet points of view. In addition, the KGB analysed targeted journalists in terms of possible blackmail or kompromat, compromising material. This especially held true for journalists who might later find themselves in an important position, such as a press spokesman at a ministry. We later talk about Hans's visit to a Soviet chemical weapons facility and testing ground on the Volga, some 750 kilometres southeast of Moscow, as well as his service in the Dutch Army. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave a written review in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. If you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get that sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly supporter of the podcast. You also bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Back to today's episode. We welcome Hans to our Cold War conversation.
Well, after fulfilling my armed service, I went on to study Russian at university. Then got a job at Amnesty International, the Dutch section, which at the time was the biggest of them all. And from there, I became a journalist, first working with Dutch International Radio and then quitting and becoming a freelance correspondent in Geneva.
Being in Geneva, you're looking for just international stories based around the United Nations representation there, yeah?
Yes, well, the UN office in Geneva is so big and there are so many international organizations there that you have to focus on some topics. And with my human rights background, that was the obvious topic to focus on because I was well-versed in the subject. And as a sort of secondary topic, I chose arms control. And at the time, there were nuclear arms talks, chemical weapons talks, some biological weapons still going on. Those basically were the two topics I preferred. But obviously, anything that happened there that had to be covered, you covered as well.
Right, right. And how did you first come across Mikhail Petrukov?
Well, this was a very odd thing. At the time, I was looking for a new apartment to rent. So I went to this corner in this vast UN building where they had advertisements for apartments or anything for rent for sale. And I saw a man standing there looking at these advertisements. And from behind, I thought, this must be a Russian. You know, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but the type of suit, bad shoes, bad hairdo. So I asked in Russian. Finally, I had a chance to use my Russian. "Excuse me, are you from the Soviet Union?" And the guy turned around, startled almost. I said, "Yes, I am, yes." And so that's how I got to know him. Now, in retrospect, he could as well have been Romanian or Polish or what have you. But I just chose an option, and it turned out to be the right option.
Right. And then how did that sort of initial contact with him progress? What sort of happened next?
What happened next was the contact you had as a journalist with any diplomat, a cup of coffee here, maybe a luncheon there, but mainly, you know, having coffee and discussing things that were happening at the UN, nothing in particular. However, what was odd about this man was that officially he was covering UNCTAD, the United Nations Trade Development Organization. But he knew very little about that, but he knew a lot about arms control, human rights, the war in Afghanistan, and other issues that were at the time on top of the agendas. So that was interesting on the one hand, and on the other hand, slightly strange.
Right, right. And do you think that he was looking for you in the first place, or he thought that you were possibly useful after he first met you?
Again, I'm talking in retrospect, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
At the time, it wasn't probably that clear. But in retrospect, he may have been doing all kinds of things, like, can I develop this journalist as a source? Can I develop this journalist as someone who might work for us, Soviet Union? Are there things I could do as a journalist that could, in later years, make him blackmailable, so to speak?
Yeah.
Gathering kompromat, as it's called these days. But at the time, as I said, it was coffees, and it was a luncheon here and there. And then one day, he took me to a quite expensive restaurant, which for me as a poor freelance journalist was, you know, exceptional. We had a very nice lunch, and we chatted about, I don't remember what, but, you know, what was happening at the UN and in the world at large. And after lunch, the waiter came with the bill, and I, you know, sort of, I offered to pay, because you have to be polite and all that. But no, he insisted, and I'll pay. Okay, well, if you want to pay, go ahead. And then he paid, and then he did something that no diplomat would ever do. He left the bill on the table when we left. Now, any diplomat or any businessman in Geneva or whatever would have taken the bill with him so he could declare it later as expenses. Because, you know, you have an expense account. You have to present the bills. But he left it on the table. That was so, I found it, still clearly remember, I found it so strange that he did that. That it sort of put me on guard, and I thought something is wrong here. This doesn't fit a normal diplomat.
Yeah, because I understand that from your work in the Dutch section of Amnesty International, they'd sort of given you some training about possible hostile activities.
Well, training is a big word, but
they'd warned you.
Amnesty International was very much aware of attempts by foreign intelligence services to penetrate your organization and get hold of dossiers and find out what the organization was up to and things like that. So yes, we were warned about possible activities of intelligence services.
Right.
But that's different than sitting in Geneva with a Russian diplomat or a Soviet diplomat and having coffee.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I think he then did something which really confirmed to you that he was a KGB, well, some intelligence agent for the Soviet Union.
That's true. I was very deep into the chemical weapons talks in Geneva at the time, which later led to the establishment of the Chemical Weapons Convention, the worldwide ban on chemical weapons. And at one point he asked me, well, listen, Hans, you know so much about chemical weapons. Would you like to write an article for the internal magazine of my ministry? Now, he worked for the Soviet Ministry for Foreign Trade. And then he then went on to explain that obviously the article would have to be published under his name, not mine. But I would have to write it. Now, I mean, you can't have it much stranger than that. I mean, this was highly suspicious. My problem was, I could have said, are you crazy? You know, I'm not going to do that. But the guy had given me very useful information. And this is probably also the trick. You get something in return. The rewards, so to speak. So anyway, so in answering this question, I said to myself, well, what can I do? I can make an English language summary of an article that I had already published in the newspaper I worked for in the Netherlands. And so I did. And he was very, well, very grateful. And then after a few weeks, he invited me again for dinner this time, again in an expensive restaurant. And after dinner, you know, which is usually the point in time when business is done, over coffee, he pulled out a quite large envelope from his jacket and handed it to me over the table. And I thought, this is again so strange. So I waved with my hands in front of me, said, no, I don't need money. Come on. You know, it was nothing. And this gesture made me somewhat angry, because it may have been that there was someone in that restaurant taking pictures of the event. And the picture of you accepting an envelope from a Soviet diplomat could be, you know, stored in your KGB or whatever file, and could be lifted out of that file again when you would be in a position where you would be susceptible to blackmail. For instance, in my position, I might have become a spokesman at the Dutch Foreign Ministry. Why not? My experience would fit the job description. And if at that moment, working for a ministry, someone approaches you and presents that picture and says to you, you wouldn't want your boss to see this picture, would you? If you then say no, they got you. Because then, you know, you're open for blackmail. So that was, I think, the main event where he proved to be not a diplomat, but a spy.
Yeah, that's the classic compromising you with photos like that. He sounds quite amateurish in terms of the fact that, you know, he said to you he was working for foreign trade and then wanted information on chemical weapons.
It does, doesn't it?
it's not the sort of KGB we know of the spy films.
No, but I mean, obviously you have agents of all ranks and grades and capabilities. And we may come later in this conversation to another spy I knew in Geneva, who was much more capable and sophisticated, Western almost. Not this guy. I mean, he was simple. They didn't need. But, you know, I wasn't a very important target either. So, you know, I was just a journalist, like at the time, maybe over 100 foreign correspondents permanently working at the UN building in Geneva. So, you know, why waste the time of an important asset in your secret service to talk to a, you know, not that important Dutch journalist?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you compared your story with an American colleague who you'd seen in company of Soviet diplomats.
That is correct. I was working at the time in one of the press rooms where each correspondent had a small cubicle. And across from me, there was an American colleague. I believe he worked freelance for the New York Times and some other media, who I'd often seen in company of another Soviet diplomat. So after this event at the restaurant and the envelope, I asked him what his experience was with this Soviet diplomat, and it turned out to be an almost perfect copy of my story. Lunches, dinners, the request to do something for them. And so anyway, and I also went to see the chairman or president of the Association of Foreign Correspondents at the UN, a very seasoned British journalist. And he told me, oh, this happens all the time. This is as old as the road to Rome. I mean, nothing new here. And he obviously wasn't willing to take any action.
Yeah.
It was something very normal, very usual.
Yeah. Well, I think spying's described as the second oldest profession in the world.
That is absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. But you decide to, I mean, what do you do? Do you just break off all contact with Mikhail at this point?
No, I didn't, but I did want to take revenge in a way. So shortly after this episode, I went to the annual reception for the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution. And because I didn't know any high diplomats other than one or two arms control negotiators. And so I looked around at this reception and I found someone who looked to be higher up in the hierarchy. And indeed, it turned out to be one of the first secretaries of the Soviet permanent representation to the UN. And I, you know, like you do at cocktail parties, I got to talk with him. And step by step, I told him the story of Mikhail and say, you have to remember, these were the days of Gorbachev and his, you know, his restructuring of Soviet society, the glasnost and perestroika. So I told this diplomat that we were very satisfied with the new course that Moscow had taken, especially in the fields of human rights and arms control. But I said, what is so strange is that the organs, meaning KGB or GRU, are still so old-fashioned. And I then went on to explain this story about this my meetings with Mikhail. And he was very, he was a bit angry. He said, there is no KGB in Geneva, et cetera, et cetera. And I, on a bluff, I said, well, that may be, but yes, several of my colleagues, I knew of only one, but I presume there were more, several of my colleagues have had the same experience, and we are now considering to lodge a formal complaint against your mission because of this behavior. This cannot stand. This is not permissible. And he sort of waved away these words. And then the day or 2 days after this, Mikhail called me at my desk in the Palais des Nations, the UN building, which he rarely did. He always came by in person. He never called. He just dropped by in person. But he called, and we had coffee. And he said, what did you say? And it turned out that this first secretary had called a extraordinary meeting of the Soviet embassy, or permanent representation, to the UN, and said that the journalists at the UN are going to complain against us. What is this? And all that. And so my story worked in that sense. And then I told him how stupid he had been all this time. The bill he forgot to take along, and trying to get me to write something for him, and the attempt to give him to give me an envelope. And one of my best friends at the UN Correspondents Association knew the head of police of Geneva. And I told Mikhail, I said, for me, it's quite easy to have you extradited. We can just think of some trumped up charges and you're gone. And that sort of startled him because, after all, KGB people are also human beings, and Geneva was and is a very nice posting. You know, it's a very nice, clean town, very affluent. There are the mountains, there's forests. There's the lake, lovely lake. You can go skiing, what have you. And with that any attempt of Michail to compromise me or to do odd things ended. We remained in touch, and he gave me some useful information now and then, but...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
No strange things anymore.
Right. But I understand there was an exception, though, where he did ask you to do something for him.
Yes, but that was not something which could compromise me. But
yeah.
I had told him that I had worked for Amnesty International in the past. And at one of our meetings, he asked me, he said that Moscow, he didn't really specify who, but Moscow had received a letter from Amnesty International about a possible opening of an Amnesty International office in Moscow. And I was flabbergasted when I heard that because, you know, Amnesty International had been harassing the Soviet authorities about the fate of political prisoners and abuse of psychiatry and what have you for decades. So the point in time where Amnesty International could ask for to open an office in the Soviet Union was really revolutionary. But anyway, he told me, could you please tell them that it doesn't work this way? I mean, you can't write a letter and expect things to happen. They should first have a meeting on neutral ground with Fyodor Bulatsky. And Fyodor Bulatsky at the time was a very high-placed functionary and basically Mikhail Gorbachev's main troubleshooter in the field of human rights and other issues. So I called the International Secretariat of Amnesty in London, and I talked with their legal advisor, the late Sir Nigel Rodley. And I told him about, you know, this Russian guy who I presume is an intelligence officer told me this and that about the letter. And there was a long silence at the other end of the line. He said, how on earth do you know about this letter? It's highly confidential. Only I, the Secretary General, and our secretary know about its existence. Well, I said, I'm sorry, I'm just acting as a messenger. For someone who I believe is a KGB guy, and this is their message. That's all. I don't need to know more about that. And later, I heard there had indeed been a meeting on neutral ground, and yes, there had been progress towards getting an office in Moscow. But it was a quite interesting thing because the KGB or Mikhail didn't ask me in person to do something for them. He just asked me to pass on a message, and that was all. And I presumed at the time that I wasn't the only messenger, that Moscow's message to Amnesty International had gone through other channels as well. Because, you know, why run the risk of doing it only through one channel, a Dutch journalist in Geneva, and risk maybe the message getting distorted along the way or what have you. But I never heard anything about that anymore.
Right. So they were sort of using you as like a back channel to send a message to Amnesty.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And I think that whole Amnesty International office debate was quite contentious in the Soviet Union as well, because the KGB were against it and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs were in favor.
That is correct. I actually spoke at the Foreign Ministry in Moscow about this issue with people of the foreign ministry who didn't really say the KGB was against, but they hinted at it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And there's a little aftermath to this story, isn't there, in 91?
That's true. I left Geneva early 1990, went on to become a correspondent, first in East Berlin and then moved to Prague. But I often came back to Geneva because I had many friends there. And one of these times, I think it was in 1992, I went back and stayed with a good friend. And within 2 days, the press guy of the American embassy or American permanent representation to the UN called me at his friend's home. I don't know how he knew I was there. That was miracle number one or mystery number one.
Yeah.
And he invited me for lunch. And again, business was done over coffee after lunch. And he said, you knew so many Soviet diplomats when you were working here. Could you make a list for us of those of among them who you believed were working for the KGB? I said, come on. You know, I don't do such things. The only thing that was interesting for me was their information correct or not. And then he became very angry. He was smiling. He had been smiling all along the lunch. But then his face sort of changed. He became quite angry. And said, he told me, but you were in touch with the most important KGB guy in Geneva. And I thought to myself that, I said, this can't have been Mikhail. Because he wasn't that clever or he didn't make a very important impression. And it turned out to be the press spokesman of the Soviet delegation to the Conference on Disarmament, the guys that did the chemical weapons negotiations, which I had consulted often to get, you know, points of view, news, what have you. And that Russian never asked me to do anything strange and never invited me for lunch, for that matter. He was just a business contact like you had so many at the UN. And I told somewhat provocatively this American, you know, if all the Russian diplomats were like him, you wouldn't have any problems. And he said, you know, again, it was their most important agent. And then years later, courtesy of the internet, which in my time in Geneva didn't exist yet, but years later, I found out this chemical weapons spokesperson had been one of 50 Soviets or Russian spies that were the first large groups that were collectively expelled as spies from the United States in 2001. And thanks to the internet, his name was on that list. So yes, he must have been quite important.
Right. And I think you found Mikhail as well via Google.
I did, but nothing interesting. It turned out he had a job at the Russian embassy in Helsinki, Finland, and specialized in the work of the Arctic Council, which is an international body dealing with matters relating to the Arctic region. But nowadays, his name is gone from the internet.
So what were these KGB agents doing at the UN then?
Frankly speaking, I don't know. I'm not a counterintelligence specialist and had no idea exactly what they were doing. But obviously, every national delegation at the UN was trying to find out, for instance, negotiating positions of other parties. Arms control, human rights, but also trade. The General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, GATT, later becoming the WTO, was quite important for everybody. Mikhail did tell me that at one point they would copy research files of the World Health Organizations at night in the WTO building simply to save money. You know, research can be quite expensive. So if you can save money by copying research from a UN body, well, so much the better. Why they would do that at night is I don't really understand, but I'm not a spy.
So they were using, like, the World Health Organization's photocopier to duplicate these files?
Yes, exactly. And it was, of course, saving money on files, but saving money on research.
Yeah.
Back in the motherland.
Yeah, yeah. And I understand that you discovered in Oleg Gordievsky's 1995 biography why KGB did not ask for receipts in restaurants.
Indeed. Gordievsky writes, and he should know because he was very high in the KGB, that leaving the bill in a restaurant was sort of tradecraft for KGB agent because they thought that taking along the bill – or the Czech, or whatever you want to call it, was not very chic, was not very cosmopolitan. You know, it was beyond them. So just leave the bill. Doesn't matter about expense accounts and things like that. Behave in a modern way and leave the bill. That was new to me. I only read this a few years ago. I didn't know that at the time.
Well, it just goes to show how good you were at spotting tradecraft.
Yeah, well, I didn't know it was tradecraft at the time. I probably didn't even know the word tradecraft, although I was an avid reader at the time of John le Carré's novels, but the word tradecraft was not something I would use regularly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the other thing I quite liked is you discovering about the, you know, if a diplomat had been in physical contact with a foreigner, what they had to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame I didn't know that at the time, but again, like I said, there was no internet, and so your knowledge was much more limited than it is for journalists these days. But someone knowledgeable told me that any Soviet diplomat who had been in physical contact with a foreigner should come to the permanent representation just across the street from the UN at the end of the day and report this in person to a KGB or even to the ambassador, actually. Because obviously shaking hands is one thing, but when you shake someone's hand, you can also pass a microchip or what have you, a small slip of paper to the other person. So they were so paranoid, I would say, about their activities of their own people that they indeed forced diplomats to, like children, to report to their ambassador at the end of the day. It's a shame I didn't know it at the time, because I could have waited in front of the embassy and take pictures of lines of diplomats coming to report, but I didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing I found interesting was the John Tower story, which I wasn't aware of, the Republican senator who was head of the U.S. Nuclear weapons negotiating team at the START talks.
Absolutely. I did go to the building now and then where these talks took place, at least the American part of the building. And just very close by on the Rue de Lausanne in Geneva, there was a, and still is, by the way, the Mr. Pickwick Bar. And when John Tower was nominated to be U.S. Secretary of Defense back in 1989, shortly afterwards it popped up that he had been compromised by a female KGB operative, the exact details of which... The compromise, I don't know, but it must have been quite serious, because there was a FBI investigation, there was a CIA investigation, there was a CIA report about the event, and then the Senate rejected his nomination in a vote quite unprecedented. Now, female KGB operatives, in their jargon, are called swallows, like the bird, you know.
Yeah.
And their main objective is, of course, to get diplomats into horizontal action, if you know what I mean.
We do know what you mean.
And then make pictures for later use as blackmail material.
Yeah. 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 A little bit different to handing an envelope over, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, the point, of course, is I was simply a correspondent at the UN, and we presumed things like these happened, but you never get to witness them firsthand. In retrospect, I was very lucky to have had this contact with this presumed KGB guy, although he never showed me a membership card or, you know, a formal confirmation that he was KGB. He might have been GRU, military intelligence, in retrospect, because he was so interested in chemical weapons, which is more a GRU thing. But But then the GRU guy would never have to ask me about Amnesty International and stuff like that. So it was a quite interesting episode in my journalistic career, which never repeated itself, I must say, afterwards. But it was quite unique.
Yeah, no, really interesting story to speak to somebody who firsthand was attempted to be recruited as a source for or an asset for Soviet intelligence.
Yes, indeed.
Now, you've also got another interesting story I wanted to touch on, because in 1987, you were one of the delegates who were invited to see a chemical weapons facility in the Soviet Union, weren't you?
That's correct. As a hobby, or as a journalistic hobby, one of my journalistic hobbies was covering the chemical weapons talks, which had been churning along for years in Geneva without much result, until Mikhail Gorbachev came to power. And then suddenly things started to move and the talks became quite interesting. I was basically the only or one of the only journalists covering the talks and, you know, meeting with the delegates and knowing the negotiators and the people, American, Russian, what have you. And there came an invitation. Well, first of all, you must know that the Soviet Union had always denied they had chemical weapons. They weren't there. And then suddenly in 87, they said, okay, we have them. And you, meaning the Conference on Disarmament, can come and see them. So this was quite revolutionary. And I was indeed the only journalist from the UN in Geneva who was invited to come along and cover this event. And it was extremely interesting. First of all, for me personally, because although I had studied Russian, I had never been to the Soviet Union. In my Amnesty International days, it was discouraged to go there because there was too much risk of arrest or harassment. And later, my career took me in other directions. So I could finally, upon arriving in Moscow, I could finally order a bus ticket in the bus in Russian and buy cigarettes in the kiosk. I said, well, all those years of 5 years of studying Russian are finally paying off now.
Yeah. So how did they transport you from Moscow to the site? Because I think I understand it was somewhere on the Volga River.
Yeah, it was about 800 kilometers from Moscow on the Volga River in the near Saratov, the Shikhani chemical weapons compound. The delegations were flown with three military Tupolevs to the site, or to a military airfield near the site, and then by bus to the site. This was quite impressive to begin with, because the site was very well protected with, you know, lines of barbed wire. I think there were two or three cordons around the base. And inside the base, well, we finally got to see all the different munitions that the Soviet Union had at the time to deliver chemical warfare agents, ranging from hand grenades to chemical warheads for Scud ballistic missiles. I mean, there were dozens of munitions. For me, this was extremely interesting.
Yeah, and there's some great photos on your website, so we'll post links to your website so people can see those. So when you arrived at the base, how did they show you these weapons? How were they showing them to you?
Well, they had made an exhibition, basically, out in the open, where there were rows and rows of these munitions, but also chemical decontamination trucks. There were military tents. Interesting, I had been assigned a personal minder from the Soviet Ministry of Defense, an oversized guy, I should say. Look more like a boxer or something, or a wrestler, who was at my side all the time. And he accused us of being all spies and all that. It was fun.
But you were able to take photos and take notes and look around. I mean, were there any areas they didn't let you go to, or
they wanted to show. And the interesting thing is that when we were in the buses driving towards the base, they told us no pictures, no photographs. And then when we arrived, they said, okay, well, you can take photographs. So everybody turned out to have a camera with him and was avidly making photographs. And it was a very interesting, intelligence-related accident or incident. I had almost seen everything, and I had been in every vehicle and saw everything and took pictures. So I was having a chat and a cigarette with my minder. And
hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
We were standing in front of a chemical decontamination measurement truck, what have you, and up walks a diplomat I knew from Geneva. I think he may have been Australian or Canadian, something from the Anglophone world. He didn't see us. We were standing a bit on the side. And he was looking around, not in our direction, but in other directions. And he stuck out his arm, and in his hand he held a small camera, and he took pictures. And it was so funny because he could take pictures like, you know, we were all allowed to take pictures, but apparently this guy was so conditioned, so trained to take covert pictures with the camera hidden in his hand. And this Russian minder turned to me and said, what did I say about you all being spies? And we had a laugh for you.
Yeah, yeah. So this minder you had, was he, you know, polite with you, or was he was trying to intimidate you?
No, he was polite. Like, yeah. He was a bit insulting by claiming we were all spies, which we weren't. There were several journalists there. I was the only one from Geneva, but there were, I think, about five or six correspondents from foreign correspondents from Moscow, and then a bunch of Soviet media.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can understand it to some degree because it's not unknown for journalists to be used for spying, I suppose. But
no, I'm sure there have been journalists who are spies or were spies, but you know, these were, you know, bureau chiefs, yeah, of Reuters and BBC, what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just a simple Dutch correspondent from Geneva. And then the visit was split in 2 days. And overnight, we stayed in a quite luxurious cruise ship on the Volga called the Yuri Andropov, I still remember, with excellent dinner and all that, and more press conferences by the Soviets, which was okay. And for me, it was funny because I knew several of these high-placed Soviet chemical weapons experts from my days in Geneva, because I had interviewed or seen them there. So it was funny to see them in their own context, in their own habitat, so to speak. Quite interesting. And because I was in a unique position, at least for Dutch media, they had reserved at least half an hour of radio for me on the Sunday morning, which was exceptionally long, half an hour for any radio journalist. So I had prepared a broadcast, having, you know, clips on cassettes already, because they had told me, yes, sure, you can file a story to the Netherlands, no problem. So I went to the communications tent and said, hello, in Russian, I'm here to file my story for Dutch radio. And the soldier, and I said, file to whom? I said, file to the Netherlands. Can't be done, he said. I said, wait a minute, your ministry assured me that it was possible. Well, the ministry can say anything, but it's not possible. I can make a connection to Moscow for you, but that's all. And I had to think, oh, Lord, there's my radio station in Holland waiting for my stuff. What to do? So I asked the guy to call a friend of mine who was a correspondent in Moscow, and I asked her to pass on the message to the Netherlands that unfortunately there was no connection possible to from Vigani at the Volga. So that was the end of it.
Right, right. And did you carry out any interviews there, record any interviews?
I did, yes. And I recorded all the briefings. I interviewed, obviously, the Dutch negotiator from Geneva, the American one, the Russian one. I think that was it. And, well, several Soviet military people. But the interesting thing was that the Americans said they were not very satisfied because the Soviets hadn't shown everything. Now, I must stress that these munitions they showed were obviously empty. There was no nerve gas inside the bombs or mustard gas or what have you. But the Americans had expected the Soviets to admit they had binary chemical weapons, which is, you know, ammunition in which two components are kept separately until they are launched, and then they mix, and then they form a nerve gas. And they had expected to see that, but as it was very important, what you call a confidence-building measure, to show these weapons and to admit they had them. And indeed, after that, the negotiations in Geneva picked up speed and led within a few years to the Chemical Weapons Convention, which was a highly complicated treaty, still is, which entered into force in 1993.
Yeah, it must have been very difficult for the Soviet army to accept having to show what had been top secret not so long ago to effectively people from NATO.
To the enemy, yes.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But such is life for the military. I mean, if the political bosses decide to change course and engage in new ventures with the counterparts, so be it, and you have to follow them.
Yeah.
Later, I found that one of the most interesting people at this Shihani visit, and indeed I had seen and interviewed him back in Geneva, was General Kuntsevich, who later died mysteriously after reportedly or allegedly having been involved in providing Syria with nerve gas information or indeed and or nerve gas materials. And he died mysteriously in a helicopter accident of some sort. But at the time, he was just the number two in command of the Soviet Chemical Weapon Corps. For me, he was an interesting guy. But I must admit, these military, when you interview them, they don't really say anything interesting. But that goes for military all over the world, unless they're very high placed, you know, commanders in chief.
Yeah.
But routinely military don't say much. They don't like journalists. And they just, you know, say prepare text, basically.
Yeah. And you say that the obviously the warheads were empty, but did they show you at all how potent some of the chemical weapons were?
No. Well, what they did show was the effectiveness of a mobile decontamination or neutralization unit in which you can load a chemical weapons munition and neutralize it through hydrolysis to show that it was real. First of all, they made us all wear gas masks, and we were put behind a plexiglass screen. So they took a syringe and extracted some fluid from a bomb, and then went on to inject this fluid into a rabbit, a live one, which subsequently died a horrible death, shaking all over. So yes, it was indeed nerve gas. Then the bomb went into this neutralization unit, and after an hour or so, or 2 hours, they took it out again. Took a syringe, extracted fluid from the bomb, injected another rabbit, and lo and behold, it survived. Nothing happened.
Right. I mean, how did you feel when they said, look, we want you to put on these masks? Because, I mean, that implies that this experiment could go wrong.
Well, I think there was a highly theoretical risk of sarin. It was a sarin-filled bomb, of sarin escaping from this bomb and spilling off to the area where we were all sitting. But first of all, they had this plexiglass separation wall, so to speak, to protect us. And then we all had to wear a gas. Well, we didn't have to wear it at that time. We had to keep it ready. And before this experiment started, we all had to test our gas mask in a gas tent, which brought to me memories back from my army days, where we also had to do that. You know, you fill a tent with tear gas, and then have everybody check if their gas mask fits all right, because if it leaks, the tear gas takes hold of you. But I think that's what just an insurance policy in case something very strange would happen. Yeah.
And lastly, I mean, you mentioned earlier as well that you served in the Dutch Army. What was your role there?
I was a gunnery sergeant, conscripted, of course.
Yeah.
And my task was to operate a computer with which to direct a artillery battalion.
Right.
To make sure that the shots arrived on target.
Yeah.
In time.
Yeah.
And for me, it was interesting because I was based, after basic training in the Netherlands, I was based at a Dutch brigade in West Germany, and which where my interest for the Soviet Union and East Germany was vastly increased because they were so close by.
And what were you? I mean, when you were in the army, what were you told about East Germany and the Soviet Union as far as you know, why you were there and why the army was there?
Hardly anything. My job was very technical. My task was to eliminate advancing Warsaw Pact units based on direction given by a forward observer. So the forward observer would call me on the radio and designate the target, give a target description, map coordinates, which I then entered into my computer, and lo and behold, results came after a minute or two.
Right.
But there was no ideological indoctrination or anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And did you, during that time, were you taken on a trip up to the border to actually see what it was like?
No, I wasn't, nor was my unit. But these days I follow websites of army veterans, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite normal for Dutch conscripts to be taken to the Iron Curtain, have a look. Mind you, not in uniform, not to cause any problems there.
Right.
But just to have a look at the border. Just like they went to, for instance, the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp to commemorate what happened there. No, there was no. Maybe in training we got to see a movie about the Soviet threat, probably, but I don't really remember. That's probability.
And was this the early 80s that you were in the Dutch army?
Make that the early 70s.
Early 70s. I was just because, you know, the Dutch army is an interesting army as far as NATO is concerned because of the conscription. I've seen these photos of some of the strange, not strange hair, but longer hairstyles in the Dutch army.
Oh, I was a long-haired sergeant. The year 1971, when I entered military service, was the year where they stopped cutting or making cutting your hair obligatory. So all the young guys, like myself, we went into the army with long hair and kept it long. And, well, that was it. But I do remember that our capabilities were quite good. I first took pride in when there was an international artillery competition with our British and American neighbors. We won in terms of being able to deliver artillery fire in time and on target. Why did we win? I think because the average education level of the conscript was so high compared to American and especially British troops that it gave us a big advantage.
Right.
And there was no problem. I mean, everybody did what they had to do. There was no problem with motivation. People weren't really enthusiastic about it because most saw it as a waste of time, but they did what they had to do.
Yeah. And how long was your national service for?
As a non-commissioned officer,
yeah.
18 months.
18 months. Okay. Okay. And then did you get recalled back at various periods to keep the training?
I could have been, but I think 1 or 2 years after I left the army, I got a letter saying that my war destination had been cancelled. So that was it.
Right. So they trained you for 18 months and then you weren't kept on the reserve.
They train you for about 6 to 8 months.
Yeah.
Then you are sent to a ready unit for your actual service. There's no more training. Well, there's no more really important training after that.
Yeah.
It's just practice.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.